Are you working? What kind of work do you do? What is it you want to do when you grow up?
Hey, yo, I'm going to be a tit-op. That's all my eyes can see. Victory is mine. Yeah, surprisingly, I've been laying. Waiting for your next mistake. I put in work and watch my status escalate. Now I'ma start collecting props, connecting plots, networking like a conference. Cause the nonsense.
So yeah, watch this. Yeah, one of those dystopian future movies.
So you mean like a documentary of today?
Well, it was so what happened was there was this overlord dictator and his name was Adam. And he decreed that you could only have greatest hits albums, and you couldn't produce anything else that wasn't a hit single. And the world was terrible.
This is shit, man. You can do better than this.
I was, the Faith No More slagging off was a bit harsh.
What do you mean it was a bit slash? Your slagging off of Faith No More was so bad I had to walk off the fucking stage and go and get a beer. Look, it's not... There are people who don't think it's a very good album. Those people include Adam and myself.
It's not the fact
I
that
I think
it's,
we can all move on.
It's no, it's more the fact that... I don't know. I'm starting to come around to the... An album doesn't have to be all hit singles. You know, it can have a bit of ebb and flow to it, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, but it's all got to be worth listening to. And this is what I never understood about your position on Angel Dust, is that you'll freely say, some of this stuff is unlistenable and I will skip it.
Two songs,
that
yeah.
That immediately makes it not a good album. Because a good album should be listenable end to end. It doesn't have to be fucking Beatles-style pop hits end to end.
Yeah.
But it's still got to be... listenable end to end. And if you're skipping tracks, it's immediately off the table.
Okay. Everyone has their own internal rules, and that's definitely not mine. I think an album can still be great with bad songs on it.
But that's just a collection of songs you like, which is no different or better than a singles album.
No, it's not. No, I don't think so.
It's literally the same thing. I mean, if you've got an album with songs on it you don't like, you don't like the album. You like the songs on it that you like. The album is the whole thing. It's the 12 tracks, the 15 tracks. As a journey, end to end. Minute zero to minute 53 or 82.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, but you can still enjoy an album as part of the journey if you don't like two tracks. It's not like those two tracks make that whole album experience invalid.
Well, you could enjoy it, but it's not a great album if it's immediately... I mean, it's like starting with an arm tied behind its back. It's like it's handicapped out the race.
Yeah, but if the other songs are of a certain quality that makes that okay.
No, I see your point, but I don't see that makes. I don't think you can have a classic album where you.
So King for a Day, right? King for a Day has.
It's a better album.
It's a much better album. It's much better end to end. You don't skip any tracks, but I would say the highs are nowhere as near as high as Angel Dust.
Well, it's certainly more.
It's a much more even album, but
yeah, that
doesn't
agree.
Have.
I thought we already litigated this.
Probably,
I'm not relitigating the fucking Faith No More discussion. I don't even like Faith No More.
All right, shall we talk
about
because
they're so fucking prog and fucking up themselves.
Let's
talk about Gangsta.
Oh, you want to start with Gangsta?
We'll start with your classic. We'll start with.
Really flipping it up while I've gone away.
Well, because I'm interested in seeing... I mean, I can't ask you why you thought this was a classic because you'd never fucking heard it before you picked it.
Well, okay, so by your...
and it doesn't really fit the same model as when we did Stone Roses because that one at least had
been earmarked as a classic. Amongst a specific subgroup of my friends. Well,
you're about
like
to drop out.
All those
Goodbye.
Australian hip-hop guys
Goodbye.
That I...
I miss
hung
you.
Out within
Bye-bye.
That time period. All of them think of that way, the same way.
Have a nice night. Fuck you, Malcolm. Fuck you in the face, Malcolm. Oh, he's come back!
I'm back.
A save!
I think it is.
So what was all that?
I was just saying it is a classic the same way the Stone Roses was, but just to a different group of people. It has that same feel.
I would have, the thing is with these guys. So, spoiler alert, cut to the chase, too long, didn't read. This is pretty conventional late 90s hip hop. It's not out the box. It's just about what you'd expect for that genre. And if you dig a little bit into their back catalogue and a bit of their backstory, you understand that they're really revolutionary stuff that is the stuff that I presume is what the heads are all into, was 1991, 92. By this stage, they hadn't even been playing together for the last 5 years. They'd long since split up, gone their separate ways, were doing solo stuff. And the DJ side had been producing Jay-Z and Biggie and people like that. So why, it's not surprising that it kind of presents as, rather than the kind of weird, interesting, instrumental acid jazz hip-hop that they were doing in the early 90s, it was much more conventional sounding hip-hop by this stage of the 90s, because this dude's thumbprints were all over Jay-Z, Biggie, and a whole lot of East Coast hip-hop artists.
I think the thing about this is I can understand how this would have sounded a lot fresher at the time, but it's got so many, as you said.
So this album has been specifically quoted by your head friends? Your head friends.
They said three. They all couldn't sort of agree on which of the three were better, so this one and the two before it.
Yeah, because there's a long gap. There's like, they did like two albums like 91, 92, and then there was like a 94, and this is 98. So this is, it's fair to say this is long post-peak. They hadn't actually been working together very much in the preceding 5 years or so.
Oh, actually, so I really like about 9 songs on this album, but they're just
There's like 27 songs on this album.
Yeah, there's 27 songs, and out of those 27, there's like 9 skits where they probably only needed 2, and a couple of collaborations which just don't work.
Yeah, and a lot of fairly generic R&B loops and some really boring, I shot the fucking dickhead who was trying to steal my shit and then I cracked onto a girl kind of hip-hop lyrics, which I know is just as dumb as rock songs about sex and drugs and rock and roll, but it is a very boring fucking trope that is always rolled out in, particularly in hip-hop of this era.
Hip-hop of this era almost had to have I'll kill my enemies sort of song, and it had to have
I'll shoot dice on the corner and then shoot some cunts up. You know, it's the fucking, I always think of Regulate by Warren G and Nate Dogg, which is one of the single dumbest fucking songs in the history of the world.
And
basically, I had dice and then I shot a bunch of dudes and then I cracked onto some chicks.
Yeah. And yay. And the only thing that makes it redeemable is watching the Muppets do it on YouTube. It is hilarious. It is one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
I much prefer the Muppets version of Sure Shot by the Beastie Boys.
Mm. Oh, this one's a little bit better in the film clip because they've managed to cut Muppets things to make it suit the narrative. Like, it actually looks like the Muppets have done a rap video for this song.
If you smoke like I smoke, then you're high like every day. I'd like to
And just like walking into a street with a bin burning and, it's really well done. And they did have songs with much more interesting lyrics, a little bit more, you could see the social conscience that guys like Questlove sort of coming through. But, there was just a few too many bits around it that I didn't like to make the bits that I really did like. And there was like 2 or 3 songs I really liked. Obviously, the one I picked the album from, Work, I think that's great.
Which ironically has the same fuck boring lyrical content about I'm going to come and shoot you in the fucking head.
Yeah, but I like the flow and the beat of that song.
I mean, it's structurally a good song, but it's lyrically just
And I like his beats. I know some of them were a bit sort of off the shelf. I wonder whether they're off the shelf at the time, though, or whether they've just been recycled so many times by...
You know what it is. It's the fact that the rest of the game had caught up to him because he was giving his beats to everyone else. Because he was the producer on Jay-Z's first album. He was the producer right at the start of the game for a lot of these really seminal acts who went on to take those ideas through. So that's why this doesn't sound like anything out the box, because this is what the sound what became and was.
Yeah.
So it's they could well have been, you know, they were innovators at the start, but the game had caught up to them by this. And also the fact that I get the impression, and your hip-hop mates can probably inform on this, this isn't an album that sounds much like their first two albums. That certainly seems to be the word in the reading I've done on it. It's this doesn't sound that much like,
yeah, it's more
Step Into the Ring or anything like that. It's much more
conventional,
state of the art. Yeah,
yeah, and their real jazz influence stuff is what made them, I think. Like it was their sound. So.
Yeah.
That's
a jazz hip hop thing. It was a real thing in the early 90s, you know. And we pulled out a US 3 thing for the show notes last week.
Yeah, and Guru did an album called Jazzmataz, I think, with a bunch of French jazz artists and MCs, which is pretty cool.
It felt like that was his, you know, the acid jazz thing was his thing.
Yeah,
much more than it was
Premier.
That's right. Yeah. Premier's the producer, the DJ. Much more the producer was. It was much more straight down the line.
But I've really enjoyed having a dig in their sort of back catalogue, though. Like not be on this album as well, because I can really see how some of those early Australian hip hop artists like Bias. And the guys out of Adelaide were
roughly contemporary, though, weren't they? I mean, Shinky Row were like 91, weren't they?
Yeah, Shinky Row. Like, these guys were just starting to come onto the scene,
yeah,
sort of 91 through. So, and this is the stuff they would have been listening to. So,
yep.
I don't know, that aesthetic is definitely, I can definitely see this band's aesthetic in some of the stuff that I was listening to when I first started listening.
Yeah.
Not the Resin Dog stuff, because that's more party, but the more underground stuff had that same sort of feel. Same flow, I guess.
Yeah, I have to say I was disappointed to hear them leaning on the same old tropes and the same old sound, given that I knew that they were, you know, because my recollections of them were as this effective, as I say, acid jazz hip-hop band.
Mm.
And admittedly, their most, let's say, popular single is actually a remix. But the original version isn't that far different. It's just
it's a bit slower and a bit darker,
riff.
I guess,
but it's still the same kind of idea.
Mm.
It's not. It doesn't sound like fucking. It just doesn't sound like.
I do think. It wouldn't have sounded as cliched when it came out in 1998 because...
Oh, yeah, it would have been much closer to the state of the art.
Yeah, there's a whole heap of this sort of stuff coming that hasn't come yet. But, yeah, they're definitely on that more commercial, more... I don't know if mainstream's the word, but they were going for a more accessible sound.
And you get the feeling that maybe Premier's peak beats were being used for his commercial
Right. Well, that's...
By now, Gangstar was a low priority side project.
Yeah, that happens to a lot of those producers. So.
Indeed.
So, which one of the two new albums? Because
I picked a couple of Eastern themed bands because of the my own perception that I was picking too many dudes and it was a bit of a sausage fest. Let's start with. The Julie Ruin.
I'm glad you said that.
Why are you glad that you said that?
Because I want to finish. I want to finish this section on a positive, and I couldn't do that about the Julie Ruins. Unfortunately,
that's interesting because the Julie Ruin has a twist in the end that I won't give away. But so how would you describe the sound of the Julie Ruin?
Flat monotone vocals with a high school backing band.
So it feels like this is a bunch of fucking 20-year-old hipsters from Brooklyn with snotty attitude and kind of DIY punk rock kind of aesthetic, doesn't it?
Mm, it does.
It's kind of you used to listen to it and there's a lot of... But also kind of throwback to early 90s. So, yeah, that it's female lead singer sounds a bit kind of...
It's just a... It's a really... Like...
It's deliberately discordant. It's meant to be kind of DIY and lo-fi, isn't it?
Are they... Do you think they're going for that sound? Is that what they're trying to get to vocally?
Oh, absolutely. That's exactly what they're trying to go to. So that sound is a... I mean, we've heard it with bands like... I mean, we talked about it when we talked about it a couple of weeks ago. When we talk about things, we talk about things. Sound like fucking Phil Simms from the NFL coverage. But we were talking about bands like The Greats and the Yeah Yeah Yeahs with Karen O, who have that sort of untrained, discordant vocal mashed up with shrieking lo-fi guitars, and it's sort of very DIY and
build yourself,
which I respect the aesthetic, but it doesn't always result in stuff that you want to listen to.
I think that the music in both those bands is a lot better than this, though.
Yeah.
So if
we said that, you know, that they just sound like a bunch of fucking college students who have no idea, just trying to ape, because they're trying to ape the lo-fi bands of the early 90s, the kind of the those sorts of bands.
What's the twist to the tale?
The twist to the tale is that they're named after, I looked them up, and they're named after a Kathleen Hanna solo album. So Kathleen Hanna was the lead singer of Bikini Kill, which was one of these iconic riot girl bands of the early 90s. You know, Kathleen Hanna's like an icon of early 90s feminism. She was the one who fucking wrote the graffiti on Kurt Cobain's wall that said "Smells like Teen Spirit."
Wow.
She's like an icon of the fucking scene. The center point of the whole riot girl scene of the early 90s. The fucking and ironically, although you're not supposed to define women by, you know, the irony of defining feminists by who they're married to, but she's Ad Rock's other half.
Oh,
she's
okay.
Adam Horowitz's.
Yeah, right. So that totally makes sense.
Massive fucking superhero. So they've named this. So I looked them up, and they said they're named after the solo album of Kathleen Hanna's. I looked a bit more carefully. It's actually Kathleen Hanna's fucking side project.
This isn't
a bunch of fucking 20-year-olds. This is the latest iteration of Bikini Kill / Le Tigre / So this is not a bunch of children. This is a proper grown woman with a long career in doing this sort of stuff, doing the latest iteration of it. And I actually enjoy the album less because of that. Because the thing when I first listened to this album, I thought, okay, this is raw as fuck, and this has got, you know, it's discordant and it's awkward, but this is just a bunch of kids having a thrash, and they can build from this, and they can learn from this, and I'm sure their next album will be fantastic. When you know it's a bunch of old people, because most of the people who are playing with her are people who used to play in Bikini Kill or Le Tigre or any of the other bands that she's been in over the years, it feels like it's on the downward trend rather than the upward trend. It didn't really feel like there's really anywhere to go.
It's that Hermitude thing, isn't it? She's playing to her crowd. Like, is her crowd going to expect that sort of stuff if they were following?
Well, exactly right. I mean, there was, and I probably should have too, because there was like clear signals. There's songs like Mr. So-and-So, which was a diatribe against kind of douchebag dudes who pretend to be feminists and yet in the band scene and yet are complete dickbags.
Yeah.
But it's, So it's, I don't know what to make of it. There were some songs on there I really liked. I really liked I'm Done, which was the song that pointed me in the direction of the Julie Ruin in the first place. It was on my Discover Weekly. I really liked Time Is Up, but there was, it wasn't, my reaction to it changed when I found out
who
was responsible for it and the fact that there wasn't any scope for them to get better at this sort of thing. In fact, it was kind of the self-indulgent side project of someone who had done better in the past and now couldn't be bothered.
I struggled through this once and then quickly went, I'm not listening to that again.
No, I didn't mind it that much. In fact, I listened to it again this afternoon and there were some songs that I thought, and some songs I thought, even so, you know, it's not... Yeah, and the nice thing is that now all of the 90s fucking music geeks, all the 90s cool kids can stop screaming at us because they knew the whole time when we picked the Julie Ruin that this was Kathleen Hanna's fucking side project. And no, we know, guys. Well, and it's still not that good.
You've redeemed yourself with the second album, though.
What? I've redeemed myself with my random pick.
Yep, you have. Good random pick.
So Stonefield are a bunch of kids from rural Victoria. Basically, I think we rather unkindly referred to them as the rural Victoria's answer to the Kings of Leon, because they're all related, like four sisters from bumfuck nowhere who appear to have grown up on the diet of a lot of Led Zeppelin and Deep Purple and Fleetwood Mac and stuff like that.
Fuzzy guitars
and echoey vocals and all that sort of stuff. Mm. Organ, one-word titles.
It's awesome.
They go all right for self-taught kids from the sticks, but yeah, their sound is pretty fucking big.
I think that fuzzy guitar, echoey vocals is what I like in this sort of music, and yeah. Dream was probably my favourite track.
Dream's a good song, yeah.
And then maybe Midnight, but I like the whole album. This is straight into my short list for the top five.
I'd say Changes and Eyes I really like. The thing is that her vocal, so the lead singer's vocal, is very high-pitched. It actually reminded me, and I don't know whether you remember this band, but there was a band called The Music around in the late 90s. And it was actually a dude who did the vocal. It was kind of the band themselves were kind of like a jam band. They were almost like a bit Chili Peppery, but they did kind of funk rock. But the vocal was very much like this. It was a dude who had this very high-pitched, melodic, soprano-y kind of voice. And it sounded a lot like this girl. But and it turns out the lead singer is actually a drummer, because I looked him up on YouTube and watched a few of their clips.
Cool.
They're not great live, which worries me a little bit. But then again, given that their bass player was 12 when they got unearthed, it's hard to get a lot of gigs when your bass player's 12. You can't get into the pubs. And I'm always a sucker for girls with fucking Gibson SGs. And a girl can play well, so that's all good.
I thought the thing I liked about her vocal is it offered some variety, and maybe some of that variety was through production. Like they just didn't stick to that same echoey vocal. Like they did different things in different songs.
Well, yeah, I liked Eyes because she played a bit really more with her lower register.
It just sounded like they wanted to do a heap of different things, but they tied it all nicely together with the way they listed their tracks. Will that go into your shortlist for the end of the year, or is it just an enjoyable album?
I missed most of what you just said because Malcolm Turnbull's a cunt. I was just going to say that I enjoyed Eyes, which was one of the tracks where she played with the lower register in her voice.
Yeah.
Well, I thought that was really cool.
Well, that's actually what I just said, is I found her vocal was fairly... it wasn't one note, you know. She did some different things with it across the album. So
one of the only concerns I have is I think they've signed a Mushroom, and I get the feeling they might be a little bit like what Gudinski did with the Rubens.
Yeah.
Was they grabbed a band that were a little bit like if you get like a young footballer from a lower league club and you grab them, and in this case they were unearthed, and they've been quickly grabbed by a big label, and it's almost like you get transferred to a big club before you're ready.
Yeah,
I don't know. Judging by their live performances, some of which were like at South by Southwest and stuff, which was much bigger than and the AFL semi-finals and stuff like that. I wonder if that's a bit too much too soon, because they're still not quite. They don't have the chops for that yet.
Yeah,
so that worries me a little bit. But that's specific to the live act. It's a pretty good album.
It'd be interesting to know who produced the album, and you know whether that's a Mushroom person. And
I think it probably is. Yeah.
Well, like, and if it is, that's probably a good sign, because they're not sort of over commercializing them by putting them on a label. So.
Yeah, but I think there's a lot of production on this, and I always worry that if there's a lot of production, it's not going to stand up to being played live.
Yeah.
And if you can't play well live, you inevitably your future isn't great.
Mm.
I mean, that's certainly the case with bands like the Vines, who did well in the charts based on good production, but then whenever they had to, they couldn't sustain it based on their inability to play it live particularly well.
Yeah. Okay.
But well, yeah, it's certainly a really good album, and I'm glad this band exists, if that makes any sense. I'm glad that there's a bunch of kids. I mean, literally, the narrative might be slightly fictionalized, but they're self-taught. They're just a bunch of kids who wanted to play. The next door neighbor was a music teacher, and they all picked up an instrument and had a crack, and here we are now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. One of the most...
Really, the parents listened to a lot of fucking Fleetwood Mac and Stevie Nicks, because there's a lot of Stevie Nicks in that vocal.
When am I going to get my band where the parents listen to Portishead and Massive Attack?
It's because they would have taken so many drugs that their penis and vagina no longer work.
New music. I have two new music albums. The first one...
Tell me what these new music albums are.
The first one is Britney Spears... No, sorry. It's hip-hop, Western Australian hip-hop, Draft's new album. It's actually been...
Can I have the Britney Spears?
Oh, really? Don't like Draft?
I just figured Australian hip-hop's going to be shit-house.
Well, that depends on, what you think of Australian hip-hop, I guess. The album's called Seven Mirrors.
I thought it was shit-house.
The album's called Seven Mirrors. His last album was pretty damn good, so it'll be interesting to see what he...
For the benefit of your Australian hip-hop fan listeners, mm-hmm. I don't have an opinion on Draft.
Mm.
I don't think I've heard any of his gear.
Well, the thing is, he's got a very distinctive voice, so it is a sort of voice I reckon you could love or hate, so you might get...
Let me guess, an Australian hip-hop artist with a kind of a bogan stride? That'd be a surprise.
Mm.
Well, that'd be totally out of the ordinary.
And there's quite a few...
Will you stop rolling out the fucking stereotypes?
All right, so my second pick is going to be a band that I saw quite a bit but never really got into, and it's the Amity Affliction.
Oh.
Hardcore band.
I always thought hardcore was a very ironically named genre.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
Because they're pissant. Pissant wouldn't have been a better genre. Wouldn't have been such a good genre title, I have to admit.
I found hardcore really sort of weird in that I didn't hate it. Like, I went to a lot of hardcore gigs, but it just never... There was nothing in it that sort of reached in and grabbed me that made me... Like, I never found that one band that just did it slightly differently that really grabbed me.
Just a lot of screaming and pointlessness.
But, yeah, it's some pretty competent musicians. But anyway, the album's called This Could Be Heartbreak by the Amity Affliction, and I have heard...
I always look for competence in my music.
Yeah.
I have a minimum competence standard.
Well, some of the stuff we've listened to this year hasn't had a minimum competence
standard. Well, it's a stretch goal.
Mm.
We can't hit it every week.
So we'll see how we go. Two very different albums there.
Yes. So you've got your hardcore... hip-hop.
You could at least summon some enthusiasm. You're going to make me listen to the Metallica album, aren't you? So
there is no Metallica album. We should talk... We just mentioned briefly that Metallica's new single has hit the Discover Weeklies.
Mm-hmm.
It's hit mine anyway, because I must have listened too much of it. It must be hard if you're Metallica, because you're going to get bagged no matter what you do.
Yeah.
If you're aping their old shit, which means they're getting bagged. And if they did something weird like that fucking awful Lou Reed thing, then they'll get panned.
Yeah.
But then again, they've got heaps of money and they can get fucked.
Mm. And look, they'll go on a massive world tour and make even more
exactly
money.
Exactly right. As we said last week. It's interesting, the single feels a lot like early 80s Metallica, which itself feels a lot like Motorhead. And I wondered whether there was... Metallica are very big Motorhead fans. They've always been... Clearly, that's the band they say, this is who we sound like. So I always felt like, I wonder if that song is kind of a hat tip to Lemmy.
Well, I was going to say, maybe they're doing a Motorhead tribute album without telling anyone.
That I would like to listen to.
Mm.
Oh, there's a note here that Kathleen Hanna, one of the reasons that she stopped touring with her other bands and took a long time off and then came back with the Dooley Ruin, was that she actually had Lyme disease.
Oh, wow.
Which is not caused by having citrus thrown at you, but it's actually caused by ticks. So I was going to say this album gets a tick, which is how we got into this problem in the first place, but I don't think I'm going to even give it a tick. I enjoyed probably 4 or 5 songs on that album. So.
You really wrote a lot of jokes while I was away last week, hey?
Well, you know, you got to do something.
So what do you got for the classic?
Not like I can rely on Adam to carry the fucking content. Not like I can rely on you to carry the fucking content. Every time I do a joke, your internet drops out.
It's a conspiracy.
Malcolm Turnbull hates my jokes.
Have you got a classic classic or a classic I've never heard before classic?
No, I'm trying to continue the, if you're going to pick something with a girl in it. So I'll pick a band that has at least 50% female voice. And that band is called Spiderbait.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to pick their... I was tossing up which of their albums to pick. But I'm going to pick... I actually think that the album of theirs I like to listen to the most is Tonight All Right. But the album I'm going to pick is Grand Slam from 1999. Mm. And presumably between now and next week I'll have figured out my narrative to explain why there's a difference between those 2 points. There is in my head, but I haven't figured out a way to explain it.
I think I saw Grand Slam played live quite a bit.
Probably, because they would have toured the shit out of it. Because that was the band, that was the album with Shazam on it and various other bits and pieces.
Yep.
Stevie. I think Grand Slam has more interesting variability in terms of the song genres they pick from.
Yep.
Tonight All Right is much more of a thrash album. And I like that, but I think Grand Slam was a favourite in various workplaces I've worked, you know, research labs I've worked in. We played the arse out of Grand Slam, so I'm going to pick that. I mean, you could make a case for a lot of different Spiderbait albums as the classic. Ivy and the Big Apples would certainly be a contender. Even the Unfinished Spanish Galleon is a really good album, but I'm going to go for Grand Slam.
Mm. Okay, cool. That's a good one. I hadn't had a listen to that album in a while, actually, so that'll be pretty good to go back and listen to.
Oh, it'll be good balance with the hip-hop and the hardcore.
And the hardcore, then you've
got fucking Glockenpop by fucking Spiderbait.
We've definitely not gone with three very similar albums this week. That's
no,
sure.
it's not death metals.
So
it's not the death metal. It's the alive metal.
Yeah, well, it's better than us picking Viking bands as we've done a few times this year. So.
I didn't want that. Viking hip hop.
Viking hip hop.
That would be worth listening to. I'm sure it exists. I'm sure there's fucking Scandinavian hip hop artists.
As you have said to me before, everything exists on the internet.
Everything exists. It's like Rule 34. There's porn of everything, and there's everything else exists on the internet.
So, will you go and see Metallica when they come round, do you think?
No, I won't.
No, Adam will.
The reason is partly because, well, yeah, he will. And he'll be fucking giving it fucking heaps from the mosh pit.
Mm.
And stage diving and all kinds of shit. But no, I don't go to see live bands anymore because basically my head will ring for a month.
Ah, yeah, I get that
and
now too.
My hearing's fucked, eh? I
mean, it's really bad. You get to listen to so many very loud bands, and then it's going to be hard for you to go and see very loud bands on a regular basis.
This is true. And the other thing is that I'm sure, you know, Metallica will play Auckland and Christchurch.
Yeah.
None of those places are close to where I live.
Yeah.
And also, I had the opportunity to see Metallica at Big Day Out, and I walked out because I couldn't be fucked. Yeah. I've seen Metallica so many times on video, you know, I was never really that interested. I'm sure they would do a fantastic gig, but
I think
it's not the sort of thing you can enjoy with your girlfriend next to you because it's a very visceral kind of fascist male expression of, you know, it's that kind of experience.
Yeah.
It's not an experience you can share with your loved ones.
And I think at this stage, that, like, their thing is part band, part sort of stage, like, part show, a little bit like what U2 are. Like, U2's live
tour. They're a stage spectacular. They're basically Hamilton.
That's right. You know, there's a whole heap of production. They're not just sort of getting up and doing the songs. There's, you know, a whole little army.
They were never that big on the stage production, I have to say. They weren't like, I mean, even ACDC, you know, they have the big bell for Hell's Bells. And
oh, no, I'm not talking about that
big
sort of
inflatable,
stage,
rosy
stage direction, but like, you know, the fact that they would sort of curate their set to know that, okay, we want to bring the crowd up here and we want to, you know, let them down here and this is where we can put a new song. And look, I just think
that, having said that, Metallica have a much broader set of songs they play live. So a bit like Pearl Jam, you know, they did that tour where they didn't play the same set any night, and they released all of the sets for every night live. Metallica are like that as well. In fact, I think Adam said on a previous visit to the podcast that they release all their sets on the internet. So they'll say, like, we'll play this, and this.
Yep.
And it'll be different week to, you know, night to night.
Yeah.
But I think part of that is to appeal to the set nerds. The really rusted on Metallica fans who are like, oh, wow, they're playing fucking Creeping Death, but it's the variation they played on the single from 1982 rather than the album from 1983 or whatever. I know I have those details wrong. Don't at me. Go fuck yourself.
It's like Trainspotting for Metallica nerds.
True. But anybody who's into a thing is going to have that level of geek.
Yeah. Oh, and, you know, they're a band that's been around for a long time. So, you know, when you've been around for a long time, you basically get sort of, it's almost like you're a historian, not just a fan, you know?
Well, you also, you develop your own mythology, and there's like versions of a song that you haven't played very much, or particular songs you don't play live very much anymore. And you dust them off. And if you play them in front of a crowd, that crowd, the knowledgeable in that crowd will go, holy fuck, they never play Orion live anymore. Mm. This is awesome. This is the thing. They haven't done this since Cliff Burton was alive, sort of thing.
Yeah.
So it becomes part of the event, part of the fucking, or part of the narrative, part of the whole mythology around being a live band who plays stuff from their back catalogue.
Well, it also defends you of any accusations of just going through the numbers too. You know, if you're going to the trouble of playing a different combination of your songs every night, it at least shows that you're trying to give everybody a different experience. You're not just sort of rocking up to Twin Towns and doing another John Farnham tour.
With the Kamal experience.
Mm. I saw the David...
Adam's going to see the
David Bowie experience.
Adam's going to see the John Farnham experience too.
He's probably in the John Farnham experience, isn't he?
I don't think John Farnham wants to have that experience.
You know the best story about that. I can't remember I think I read it in a Lane Beachley article. But what's her name rocked up to a pub and there was an In Excess Experience band playing without a saxophone. And so he's sitting there going, what, I'm not even worth replicating? Come on, guys.
And the answer is, no, Kirk, no. You're not.
Yeah.
Because the saxophone is always the most dispensable part of any 80s band.
Oh, Jesus.
Anyone who you can replace by either farting or blowing a kazoo is dispensable.
Hmm.
Which is why Bezo has replaced me on the podcast.
No. That's right. Next week we'll have Kenny G and Bezo recording the Balls podcast.
Kenny G
will only reply through jazz saxophone.
Oh Christ!
I don't know. I don't know how.
Having met some of our audience, I don't blame you. Yeah. That's cool.
Yes, that might be a tad too far in terms of experience. All right, Doc. I will enjoy listening to those three albums, and I guess I'll catch you next week.
I probably won't, but I'll listen to them anyway because that's the kind of guy I am.
Yeah.
Folks, if you enjoyed this episode of the Bulls Podcast, Lifeline is one... we would recommend that you tell other people about it because a problem shared is a problem shared. Retweet us, share us on Facebook, hit us up on the internets, say hello, all that sort of stuff.
And we're not, we're not off in our high castle. We definitely don't mind a bit of chat being thrown at us.
We've got nothing else to do.
That's right, pretty much.
Respond to you ridiculous people.
Especially if you're New York Knicks fans. I love it when you...
And I certainly won't defend anything Bezo said on this podcast. If you want to chime in and tell Bezo that all his views are terrible, I'll probably support you because I'm a fucking snake. I'm the worst kind of friend.
All right, Doc, catch you on the flip side.
Cheers, man.